Welcome to the Tuesday Talk Show, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining us today. Let's see. We ask that you hold your phone calls until after the top of the hour news. But if you want to jot that phone number down now, it is 541-472-1270. When you hear the sound of the radio coming back through your phone, that means that you're next in queue. And as soon as we complete the thought that we're on, we'll put you on the air live and let you air your question or comment to our guest today. Our guest today from the city of Grants Pass, it is City Staff Day, of course, led by City Manager Aaron Kubik. And Aaron, welcome to the microphones of KAJO Radio. And I assume we're talking about parks today.
Yeah, good morning. And yes, parks will be part of that discussion today. I've got Josh with me, and we've got a lot of great things going on.
All right. First of all, though, before we get to Josh,
yeah.
I always have to ask a couple of questions.
Sure.
There has been a meeting of the minds between the city and Disability Oregon.
Yes.
To alleviate the injunction. The paper has to go before the court. Has that happened yet? What's the status now of camping in the parks?
Yeah, just last week I signed the agreement. Mm-hmm. And so the agreement's been signed. Now it gets submitted to the court. The court will then dismiss the case. And then with the dismissal of the case, the injunction will go away. Once that's done, which we're anticipating will be just a 1-3 weeks out when that's
It'll
all.
It'll take that long.
Well, you know, I do not like to promise something or have a date that I have no control over.
Well,
I
understand that.
Keeping it relatively vague and out there a little bit in the future helps us and not set up unrealistic expectations. So once that is dismissed and the injunction is lifted, we will be able to fully enforce our codes that we currently have in place when it comes to resting in public spaces. And that means individuals that are currently resting in, say, Kesterson Park off of 6th Street and other locations and some of the other parks that they're
Kesterson is certainly the most visible.
Yeah, that one's very visible, and that's why I mentioned that one. We'll have to vacate those areas, and those areas will be left again for open recreational space.
All right. Once the injunction is lifted, is there a time frame to clearing out those parks, a certain number of hours or number of days to relocate those people?
Yeah, we're going to be fair when it comes to the implementation of those codes again in the parks, and we'll provide individuals notice that they will need to vacate, and we'll also provide opportunities for them and let them know where they can go to rest. We will have those sites that we have open right now, the one on 7th Street by the police station, and the two on 6th and A and 5th and A are going to be those locations where they can go if they want to stay in Grants Pass and rest. They'll have those opportunities to rest there.
All right. Do we have a count on how full are those resting sites right now? Are they at capacity?
No, they're far from capacity. If you take a look and really look at the footprint that is taken up at all three sites, there's still a lot of room left. We have seen that there's been some resting areas, some tents that have been established that look like they were more for storage of materials and not for actual resting. So if you really take a look at that and get that dialed in, we have a lot of space. Plus, we have an annex area there on 6th and A Street, sort of by the old Yankee Pot Roast, where the on-track building was, mm-hmm. that we yet to have open, but we can open if we need additional space.
All right, so there's still plenty of room.
Yes.
All right. Now, following that up, there is $1.5 million grant up for grabs. We understand there have been several applicants for that. What's the status of that grant to create a managed homeless site?
Yeah, council has started a grant program where we're providing up to $1.2 million for capital expenditures when it comes to getting a resting site, stabilization center, navigation center, whatever you'd like to call it, up and running. Our key parameters are, one, it needs to be ADA accessible. We would like to have it up and running within 6 months. And it needs to have an inventory of allowing at least 150 people to rest. Those are the main three criteria to meet the grant. We did receive some responses to the grant. We have an internal grant committee that has been reviewing those things. And this is actually slated as a discussion item at the August 18th workshop. So we'll be discussing the grant program some more next week.
All right. With those three main criteria, if those criteria are met, that would mean that the three resting sites that we have now would be closed. Is that fair?
Yeah, the key is, and that's why we have those three things there. The court system has basically identified what is objectively reasonable for our community. Due to the ambiguity in House Bill 3115 and ORS 195, which is what is implemented the time, place, and manner for the state of Oregon, there is very little definition of what objectively reasonable is. So if it's not defined in legislature, then it ultimately, the way it is written, going to be defined in the 27 different circuit courts throughout the state of Oregon. So for Josephine County, our circuit court has determined that what's objectively reasonable at this point for this community of Grants Pass is that our sites have to be ADA accessible. You have to provide an opportunity for at least 150 people to rest. So now that we have that defined, that's our ultimate goal. And once we have those open, let's say it's phased in. Maybe someone is going to apply for a grant and they can do 50 right, you know, within 60 days, and then it takes another 60 days to do another 50, and then another 60, whatever it is. As it's phased in, whether it's all at once or stair-stepped, we can start reducing some of the capacity that we currently have at our resting sites.
All right, and that will be before the city council at a workshop on the 18th, is that correct?
Yeah, we're going to be discussing the grant program some more on the 18th.
So that's moving relatively quickly.
We're trying to get that done quickly because ultimately we know that there will be a better service for the unhoused provided if we can get that to a nonprofit to provide those services.
All right. Well, that's one we'll be able to, had to get those questions out to
you. Oh, most definitely. It's a big deal.
I've got you on the hot seat. People, that's what people want to know.
Yeah, I'm starting to sweat. It's getting so high in here.
No, we'll turn up the air conditioning and keep you on that seat. In the meantime, I want to thank you very much. And you brought in your director of parks here today.
Yes.
Which kind of fits in with what we've been talking about. Josh, how's all this affecting you and what's going on in our parks now?
So as we went into the summer season, one of the nice things was we were able to negotiate with our attorneys to be able to get majority of our parks as non-camping areas. When we made that decision, the parks that were selected were really focused on the ones that were heavily used for recreation, league events, children events, and playgrounds. So it did create a little bit of a buffer for us when it comes to this large-scale impact that was previously just spread across the entirety of the park system outside of Reinhardt and Riverside. So that's been nice for the last few months. At this point, we're really looking forward to getting back in there in some of these park areas like Kesterson to do a bunch of the irrigation repairs we need to do and spend a few weeks getting that stuff back up to being green lawns and work on rehabilitating the roses that we have in that location. So for right now, it's more or less we're just kind of biding our time and planning with our community response team on what the cleanup's going to look like to make sure that we're able to get things cleaned up. We're storing the personal property the way that we're required to by state law, as well as get these areas back up to what we expect them for our community standards.
So you're poised, but you're still waiting on the injunction to be lifted completely and the unhoused to be moved to other areas before you can move in on that.
Yeah, that's really what we're waiting on is once we get the green light to be able to go ahead, our community response team can go out and do the postings, and then we'll start coordinating the cleanup and everything like that. They give them, you know, a 72-hour notice, but what a lot of people in the community don't understand is there's laws regarding their personal property. So it's not uncommon for us to be working with someone past that 72 hours if they're making an active effort. And part of that is to make sure that we're not saddled with storing a bunch of property that otherwise cost us money to store for up to 30 days and then dispose of. And part of it's just being that good neighbor to everybody in our community to give them their dignity as we're moving them to new locations.
How's your staff handling that?
It's been real rough in general. It's kind of like the same for the last 5-6 years, though. We've been rolling through this for many, many years.
Feels like forever, doesn't it?
Yeah, and for some of our staff, they got a lot of relief when it came to being able to not have homeless individuals camping in all of our parks. Some of our staff, like our North Parks person, you know, they still have them up in Kesterson. Down at Riverside Park, our staff are still dealing with stuff down at Baker Park quite a bit, and a lot of it has been really hard on some of our contractors as well, especially for our trash can removals and things like that. A place like Baker Park, we use a Spire, and they've been moving just, you know, truckloads of trash almost every day out of that location.
Baker Park is in our headlines almost daily.
Yeah, it's a...
And a police report.
Big issue down there. And, you know, luckily we're kind of got the light at the end of the tunnel for this round to be able to go in there and make some positive changes. So,
all right. Well, I know everybody's going to be watching and rooting for all that to happen. Let's talk about some positive things, first of all. Certainly one of the jewels of your park system is Riverside Park. And we've got concerts in the park back there this year. That's a good thing. How's that going? And what's the impact on the park in terms of what you have to deal with?
So, you know, it's kind of like a night and day difference between this year and last year at Riverside Park. With this year, Riverside Park, under this news lawsuit, has been protected this whole time. So we've had many of our community events come back, and they've been just great for the community down there and really showing, like, this is what the true culture of this park is that big open space for these public venues for people to go down, whether that's parents playing at the splash pad, family reunions reoccurring at our gazebos, or concerts in the park. Concerts in the park had a great series this year. They really enjoyed being back at Riverside Park. It felt like a return to home for them, and I know it felt like a return to home for many of the people in our community. Next year, we're really looking forward to completing our Riverside Bandshell project, where we're building a stage with a collapsible bandshell to help further assist concert in the park.
Now, you just took away my next question. Go ahead.
With our Riverside Park Bandshell project, we had started the project, and we're planning to get it constructed this spring. But FEMA changed the rules for the floodplain where the current location is in December of 24, so we had to go back out for engineering and things like that. But we're right at the final part of reissuing our floodplain permit and hopefully going to have it out to bid sometime late this fall to get it built back out for the next concert series.
And what's the location going to be?
It's going to be over kind of where the Isaac Walton Building area is. It's right towards – if you look at the ball field and you're kind of like – right field, center field, right along that line, just north of there on the opposite side of Veterans Way, we have a big pine tree right there, and it's kind of going to go snap dag in the middle where that pine tree currently sits, and it's going to be facing out towards the festival field, kind of angled towards the road to disperse the noise from the concert and things like that over the bridges and the water.
All right. What will this clamshell accommodate right now? What are we talking about in terms of what can really go in there?
So it's going to be a pretty large stage. We're talking, you know, 40 feet by 20 feet, 4 feet raised stage. And then the collapsible bandshell allows us to take it down during the winter and put it back up at the spring. And they're going to be installing a three-phase 400-amp power service out there, which, you know, the concert series is really excited about because it's going to allow for larger acts to come out there and people that otherwise, besides just the concert series, if they're wanting to host public concerts, venues, or anything like that in our park, it provides a new location for that. We'll have one of the best power services in any of our park locations right at this concert stage.
Since we're talking about Riverside Park, and I know a lot of people would love to see the Back to the 50s car show back in Riverside Park, is that a possibility? I know they've had it at the fairgrounds successfully, but I still hear rumors that they'd like to go back to Riverside Park.
Yeah, and, you know, they're welcome to come back to Riverside Park at any time. Part of the issue that I heard last they were having was needing, like, overnight security because they leave the cars on site overnight, and that was one of their reasons for not coming back this year. I know at the fairgrounds it provides a lot more site security for them, but at any moment they're wanting to come back, we still have all the things lined out. We can go chalk the tree lines and everything like that and get them up and going.
All right, so good things for Riverside Park. That's certainly one of the jewels. The other jewel is Reinhardt Volunteer Park, which has been pretty immune to the impacts that we've had, which is almost surprisingly with that footbridge going across to Tussing Park. So what's the status there for both of those parks for you?
So Reinhardt and Tussing both are protected under the current injunction. When we were able to negotiate for some of those extra park areas to be protected, Tussing was one of the ones that we made sure to include on that list. And part of that is because during the whole time we did have a lot of bleed over with the pedestrian bridge. But we still end up with unhoused people going down into the bushes and camping out and things like that. But at Reinhardt, we're pretty spot on when it comes to finding these individuals and getting them to move on type of a thing. But yeah, both those parks are back to operating really high quality. Last year, when we first got out of the last injunction, we did an investment in Tissing Park to upgrade some of the fencing, upgrade some of the pathways, and redo a bunch of the irrigation lines that had been broken. And so at this point, you know, we're able to get that grass back up to being green, and it's that great south side of the city connector into Reinhardt again.
All right, so that's good news. So both of is Tussing back up to where you want it right now?
I think there's always more that we could be doing.
There's always more.
Yeah. But it's getting there for sure. We did reseed a large section of the lawn. We had lots of lawn areas that were pretty much bare dirt once we got the unhoused out of that location. And so, you know, we're still waiting for the grass to come back completely in some of those areas and fill back in. But we'll be working on that over the fall and spring season, too.
Now, did I understand you to say that you're still finding some homeless going out and camping there in the bushes? Is that still a situation? What kind of patrols do we have going through there? Is there an answer to that question?
So as far as patrols go, we do have law enforcement that patrol most of our parks, hopefully daily. It just depends on the amount of free time that they have. And then we've got staff on site at both those locations looking for things Monday through Friday. And then our citizens are very quick to report things to us. They come right up to the parks office and let us know. And our responses for those types of things are real quick when it comes to getting them out of there, because it makes it a lot easier for the cleanup if we're able to get to them quicker. And, you know, it's always been like that. I think there's this misnomer in the community that, you know, nobody ever stayed at Reinhardt Park, but anywhere that you've got vegetation that people can crawl and hide into, you're going to end up with individuals down
there. So that's been an ongoing problem for a long time, just not at the degree that we've seen it in the last few years.
Yeah, normally it's like one camper, two campers a month type of thing. And a lot of times it's people that when we make contact with them are newer to the community and they just didn't even know that this is a spot they're not allowed to camp. And so they move on to other areas.
All right, so we've talked about two of the jewels. Tell me about what we've talked about, Kesterson, and what to expect there once the injunction is totally lifted. Tell me about the rest of your Parks Department.
So right now we're pretty excited for our Movies in the Park series. We started that last Friday at Reinhardt where we did Cool Runnings. This Friday, August 15th at Riverside Park, we're going to be showing The Wild Robot. The movies start around dusk, so 8:30, 8:40 is about when that's going to show, and Wild Robot's a great movie to show for kids in the park.
And Friday night, it'll be cool again. High that day is 87. That's almost sweater weather after what we've been through. So
yeah, I think
that should be a good one.
It's one of those things we're all working towards Friday.
It's all relative, isn't it?
Friday, but just to get back to that 87 temperatures. And then next Friday on August 22nd at Redwood Park, we're going to be having a Minecraft movie, which was a pretty big blockbuster movie for – I think it exceeded many people's expectations with the Minecraft movie. So that's what we've got coming on the next two Fridays is our Movies in the Park. Again, those start right around dusk, so 8:30, 8:40-ish is when they're going to be starting. Another cool thing we've got coming to the community over the next few months is our Little Libraries program. Our recreation coordinator, Julia Wright, went to an Oregon Recreation and Parks Association Leadership Academy. And as a part of the academy, she needed to come up with a capstone project that would improve our park system. And so she created a project where we're going to be installing little lending library type things that you see in a lot of residential areas at many of the playground locations so that we can help promote children reading and things like that within our park system. And so we've got all those library kits together. Once it hits 100 degrees, our staff are going to be indoors putting those together. We made sure to save it for the summer for this type of weather and or a smoke event. And we're going to be launching that here shortly so that, you know, she's got some partnerships already made with our local library to get some free books to go in there to kind of start it off. But the idea is it turns into that lending library where someone goes to the playground at Riverside Park, pulls out a kid's book they want to take home, puts one back, brings it back type of a thing.
And is it targeted at the youngsters or would it be both? Mom can pick up a book to read while the youngsters are going through the splash park.
So when it comes to these lending libraries, you never really know exactly how big of a scope you're going to end up with as community members start adding books to it and removing books from it. But we're definitely targeting these more towards the younger kids since we're going to be locating them around our playgrounds.
You know, I see those everywhere. I've yet to ever take advantage of one, although I do love to read. Tell me about going into something like that. I would expect that there would be a tendency for the books to disappear and not be replaced. Or are people pretty pretty good about replacing something like that?
I think in general, people are pretty good about replacing them. The little library, lending libraries, have been around for a long time now, and we see them all throughout our community. There's a couple up on Washington, and, you know, personal experience, my kids have pulled books out of them, and we've replaced books in them type of a thing. And once you know they're there, I think that's what it turns into, is a family that went to a playground location, pulled out a kid's book. If they're done with the book, when they go back to the playground location, they can just bring it back and drop it off.
And just replace it, or
replace it and recycle it. But we'll have a stockpile of books that have been donated from a couple of our local book vendors to be able to keep up those stores as well.
All right. So do you have plenty?
Yes.
Ah, okay. So you're set there. We're talking about parks in Grants Pass right now with the city manager and the park superintendent. We'll continue this conversation when we come back right after this word. Welcome back. Tuesday Talk Show in progress, ladies and gentlemen. City staff is in, handed, of course, by City Manager Aaron Kubik. And Park Superintendent Josh is here with us today. We're talking about parks and what's going on with the parks and what to expect. And there's some good things here that we're learning about today. And we talked about the injunction a lot. This might be just a little bit aside here, but we've got about 4 minutes before the news pops up here. So let me pose this question, because I know that there have been lots of talked about the homeless in the parks. What about the parking situation in the parks, where I know Gilbert Creek, for instance, jumps up there? There are a lot of homeless campers in that parking lot. Does this injunction flow to them? Where does that stand? And either Josh or Aaron can jump in on this one. Do we have any situation to alleviate that situation, or is it ongoing, or is it really not a problem?
Well, I think the last statement, is it really not a problem, I think is that's a perception issue, and it could be a problem in some areas and not, depending on who you are and where you live. We do have codes established with regards to regulating parking. And when we have the injunction lifted, we do have the opportunity to enforce our resting in public spaces again. And that includes parking lot areas also. So at that time, we'll be able to enforce our codes as we have them on the books. And parks are closed. You know, they're closed from dusk until dawn. And that would mean the parking lots also. And so we'll be able to continue to enforce car camping in public spaces like those locations also.
Now, and the one I'm familiar with is Gilbert Creek, and sometimes it's full first thing in the mornings. It varies. But if we move them out of that parking area, they're going to move onto the streets. Is there another place to herd them to, or is that a situation you haven't dealt with yet?
Well, we do have about 2 years ago, we changed our codes to allow for a parking program to be established in the city of Grants Pass. Some communities throughout the state of Oregon have done the same thing. We followed the guidelines established in ORS 195, which is basically Senate Bill 3115, that states that you can regulate car camping when it comes to resting, and you can establish a program. We do have a program in place that will allow for nonprofits or other or even for-profit businesses that have larger parking lots to designate their areas for resting in public spaces. It does require them to have, like, hand-washing station and restrooms. You can regulate how many vehicles are in there and the timing of their resting. So we do have an opportunity for the community to step up to provide places for people to rest, and that would be not for the Joneses that are coming from Indiana and hanging out with their RV. This would be established for individuals that are experiencing being unhoused. Beyond that, we have our current codes that are in place that does provide an opportunity for people to park their cars on streets for up to 72 hours, and we will be continuing to enforce those codes.
All right, first of all, the situation where the nonprofits or religious facilities,
yes,
for instance, may have parking lots. That program has been in place for a couple of years, and you've had very few takers, from what I understand.
Yeah, originally when we established it, we had a couple of churches that came and asked us some questions from an administration standpoint on how to implement and what it would take. But we have yet to have anyone apply to utilize their space for that type of activity.
All right, and parking on the regular streets for 72 hours. That's basically 3 days. That sounds like an enforcement problem right now. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I'm trying to figure out. I don't understand what you mean by an enforcement problem.
Well, I mean, I can take you to a place where I know that there have been vehicles parked for longer than 72 hours, several.
Yeah,
and that's just in my little circle.
Yeah, I think we do a good job. We have a parking enforcement team, and we have, of course, our patrol officers, et cetera, that have an opportunity to regulate, mark, tag. But that is an issue not just with the unhoused, but even with oversized tractor trailers,
right,
and with residents parked on the street. I know there's a car that's in my neighborhood that hasn't moved for probably 2 months. I'm not calling it in. But we have many different uses of our public streets and people's vehicles being parked. And there's a lot of examples where they're being parked for more than 72 hours. We are complaint driven to some perspective also. So if you do recognize whether it's in your neighborhood or somewhere that there is a car that's been in location and not moved for 72 hours, give our public safety a call, or you can register that online through an online system, and we will go take a look at that if we're not proactively have an opportunity to take a look at that and address that issue. And then those cars do need to be moved, and they need to be moved a certain amount of distance in order for them to be in compliance.
All right. And I'm not taking the city police force to task or the other enforcement people there, because I know we're basically understaffed. And the police force in particular is very busy anyway.
Yeah, we are. And that's actually another topic that we're going to be discussing on the 18th. This upcoming workshop is public safety and what type of services and level of service we're going to look for in the future. The city council did provide us with direction to go ahead and look at hiring some additional FTE, and we'll be discussing that on Monday.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to hearing that one. Josh, stand by here, and thank you very much, both of you. We'll be back right after news. You're listening to KAJO Grants Pass. Welcome back. Tuesday Talk Show in progress. Ladies and gentlemen, the number to call is 541-472-1270. If you have a question or comment to our guest, if you hear the sound of the radio coming back to your phone, that means that you're next in queue. And as soon as we complete the thought that we're on, we'll put you on there live and let you pose your question. In the meantime, once again, welcome to our guest. It's City Staff Day today, headed by City Manager Aaron Kubik. And we're talking about the parks. Got Parks Director Josh right here on hand with us. And gentlemen, once again, thank you very much for your time. Josh, you came in here with a whole list of things going on in the parks, and we have just yet to start down that list. So what's next in a row that the people need to know about their Grants Pass City Parks?
So next, let's talk about the caveman pool. Our caveman pool season with our partnership with the YMCA has been going on for many, many years, and they've been doing a great job at operating our facility. This year, they are closing a week earlier than normal. What we didn't realize going into this year was normally our contracts have them going until the week right as school starts. School starting earlier this year. So the caveman pool is going to be closing on the 24th this year instead of normally would be the 29th. So that's just the first thing with the caveman pool, is that it is going to be closing a week early this year. All of the lifeguards are going back to school. That's pretty much what ends up happening when the school starts.
All right. Let's talk a little bit more about the pool. All right. Once it's closed this time, what are the plans for the pool right now in terms of repairs or replacement going forward? Is this a time to talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah. So with our caveman pool, we do have a workshop scheduled for September 15th with our city council to have our next round of conversation about how we want to proceed forward with this pool facility. Whether that's going to be looking again at rebuilding a new facility, doing renovations to this facility, what exactly it is we're looking at in the future, and identifying what type of funding we want to utilize for keeping this asset around for our community members. Generally, once we close the pool down, we start our off-season maintenance. We're going to be draining the pool out. This year, we've got to inspect our drain covers and things like that because of the way the rules change with OHA to make sure that they're all up to compliance. And then, you know, depending on what council's direction is on the 15th, we may be looking at doing more, or we may be trying to figure out what we can do to just preserve it as a year-by-year basis like what we've been doing for many, many years. So hopefully we'll be able to get some good direction from council on the 15th about exactly what they would like to see and envision and moving forward with Caveman Pool to keep it open for future generations.
Now, hasn't the high school utilized the pool for physical education in the once they get the school back up and running, and that's not going to happen this year?
So it depends. Occasionally, if we're able to get the pool up and running towards the end of the school year, sometimes we will open it up earlier in January or in June. Is it June when it opens? Yeah. Early June, so that the high school can go do PE activities at the pool.
So they don't do it in the fall?
Normally not in the fall.
Okay.
Normally it was a June timeline, and we haven't been able to do that for the last few years because when we go to start up the pool, we've been running into a lot of new issues that we're having to address, and it ends up pushing our own timeline of when we expect to open, like the third week of June out occasionally, like what happened with this year.
All right. Looking at that that pool facility, which I know a lot of people love the pool. It's been here forever and ever, and people rely on it. But at the same time, there are some major repairs that are needed. Is that right? Is that fair?
Yeah, there are major repairs that are needed at the pool. You know, we've got a substantial leak from the vessel as well as some of the underground piping. We've got a failure in a drain system that's supposed to keep the groundwater out, which is causing some issues with the basin of the pool itself. And then we've got a lot of really just old equipment. The pool was built in the 1950s. I think the last time it had a major upgrade for equipment-wise was in the 80s. So our boilers, our chemical equipment, things like that, a lot of that is pretty outdated, and it's prone to rust. We've had an Anderson pool report back in 2019 that detailed many of the issues that we're working on addressing almost every year when we go to restart it, replacing valves and things like that that have just rusted out, because there's a shelf life on all of this equipment, especially equipment that's being chlorinated. And, you know, we've kind of reached that shelf life with many of our things. Our heat exchanger, our boiler, all these types of things are just at that point to where any given day, any given season, we're not sure if it's going to continue to operate. But luckily, our certified pool operator staff have done just an excellent job at maintaining this facility with these issues for the last 10 or so years to make sure that's still available to our community. It's just we know that it's reaching a point to where any day it could just be the final nail in the coffin for this pool facility.
So basically, its life is over and we're just putting Band-Aids on it year to year. Is that a fair assessment?
That is definitely a fair assessment. You know, Flex Seal, things like that.
Okay. Oh, geez. All right. They're not shooting any commercials out there, are they?
No. Not yet. But it'd be great to have them as a sponsor.
All right, we'll put that word out as a matter of fact. And that's coming up before the city council again. What'd you say, the 24th?
September 15th.
September 15th. All right. So look for that. They're at a business session coming up for the city council in September. All right, moving on. So the pool is going to close early this week. What's next on your list?
Next we can go down to our grant we received for our urban forestry program. Last year we applied for a grant through the Oregon Department of Forestry for their urban and community forestry program. And we ended up receiving just a little bit south of $600,000 to go towards urban forestry work within the city of Grants Pass. What we're hoping to accomplish with this grant is doing a complete citywide tree inventory of all of our public trees and right-of-way and semi-public right-of-way trees. We expect there to be about 15,000 trees in the city that we'll be collecting the data on so that we know what the health of our trees is, be able to determine species diversity and things like that to make sure that we're keeping a healthy tree canopy, as well as part of the project's going to identify future planting sites to expand out our tree infrastructure. And we are creating a software program that's going to allow us to better manage and track these tree issues that occur. So when our urban forester goes out and does an inspection on a tree, we're able to actually track that within a software app. So we're pretty excited about that aspect of the grant. But other parts of the grant is going to give us 40 trees to plant on School District 7 properties. And we've been working with our counterparts at School District 7 to identify species and planting locations. Part of that is not only to expand our urban tree canopy, but also bring in that youth education aspect of the grant, as well as, you know, kind of make sure that our community members, as their young kids growing up, understand the importance and value of trees. And then we're going to be planting around 200 new trees throughout our public system, and that's going to be in our streetscapes and things like that based off the planting sites that are identified. And then one of the other sides of this grant is helping us prepare for the Emerald Ash Borer. EAB is generally what it's called, and the emerald ash borer is an invasive species. It's a native beetle to Eastern Asia that really hit the Midwest really hard and devastated their ash trees. And for years, the state's been worried about it migrating over to our side of the country. It's here now in the northern Willamette Valley. They've been finding it in some of the counties up there. And so the state's really putting a focus on making sure that you get an inventory in place to know where all your ash trees are, as well as mitigating as much as you can to lessen the impact of the emerald ash borer. So a part of the grant's going to give us funding to be able to remove ash trees that are already in decline. So we're creating less of a hospitable environment for them to eventually come down.
And that only attacks the ash trees?
It attacks a few different species of trees, but our ash tree, the Oregon ash, is the one of critical concern for us since there's so many in our state and they're all around our waterways and things like that. And they just devastate the ash tree population. There's some people in the state that, you know, think it's going to be like an ash Armageddon situation. But luckily for us, ODF has been working really hard at coming up with mitigation tools and researching and doing a bunch of stuff to prepare all the communities, as well as start to promote strains of ash trees that are going to be resistant to it. We have a lot of data that we can look back at what they've been doing at the Midwest to help us prepare for its over here. So luckily the other side of the country already went through this and we can steal their work because, you know, if not, we'd be kind of just where they were.
Percentage of ash trees within our urban canopy here?
We don't know. That's part of the
great
thing.
That's the reason for the inventory?
Yes. That's one of the great things about getting this tree inventory is we're going to know the percentage of all the different tree species so that we're able to keep not only a diverse tree species, but we're able to better balance where we're going to look at for future pathogens and invasive species that could be coming to attack our trees.
What about mitigation efforts to protect those ash trees right now? Is that available through with all of this information?
Yes. Yeah, so that's what part of this grant is for, is to help mitigate. We'll be doing some removals of our ash trees that are in decline, but additionally, there's some like systemic root injections and things like that that you can do to help protect and inoculate ash trees from the emerald ash borer that we're going to be researching. And once we know where they all are, that's really our game plan of figuring out what's the best way to kind of create a safe zone that we're giving our trees the best chance that they can to survive this.
If I have an ash tree on private property, will it also be taken care of?
No. These are for public trees only, but if you do have ash trees on private property, you can reach out to ODF, and you know they've got people that will come out and look at it through the Oregon State Extension Service.
So call ODF, don't call the Parks Department.
Correct.
Okay, all right. Just wanted to send them in the right direction.
Yeah.
All right, so if you got an ash tree, Oregon Department of Forestry, ladies and gentlemen. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more right after this important message.
At Hellgate Jet Boat.
Welcome back. Tuesday Talk Show in Progress, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about parks today. Park Superintendent Josh is with us, and along with City Manager Aaron Kubik. And Josh, we've been talking about parks here. Dollar Mountain keeps popping up here. What's the situation there for parks, and how can people really take advantage of this one?
So for Dollar Mountain, as of right now, we've completed about 8 miles of the trail system. This was a grant-funded project through the Oregon Department of Recreation. And we're expecting to complete the additional 3 miles or so starting in September, like mid-October. Our contractor pulled out due to the weather and basically our DG soils losing a lot of the moisture, making it hard to sculpt the berms and things like that for our mountain biking and hiking location. But they're going to be coming back in September and knocking out the rest of the trail system. And we should be fully completed in mid-October, where our local advisory committees and teams of our parks advisory committee, our tourism advisory committee, and even our bike and walkways committee are working on creating some form of grand opening for that. And the other big thing we have going at Dollar Mountain right now is our Highland Loop parking lot. We currently have a parking lot on Crescent Drive that was built a few years ago, and now we're going to build one on the other side of the hill up by Highland Loop by the water tower that's up there to accommodate another access point for this location. And that's just got paved last week, so we just got to do some striping and call that a day here in a little bit.
So what I'm hearing is by spring it really ought to be available to start pulling people off I-5 and into the area just to go to Dollar Mountain Park.
Yeah, and that was a big push for this project was the regional tourism aspect of it. There's a lot of data out there showing how much these mountain bike systems contribute to your local economy. I was reading an article the other day that the state of I believe it was Arkansas did a survey on what their impacts for the regional economy, and it showed that for every dollar in capital put towards building one of these locations, it brought back $4.60 into the community above that. Mountain biking is a multi-million dollar industry in the state of Oregon. It's a big leading thing that Travel Oregon's been pushing, and so they've been really helping us throughout this project to come up with plans to make sure that we're creating something that's really going to be attractive to our out-of-town guest.
All right. Let me ask a question here, because biking has really gone sky high, if you pardon that expression. Mountain biking in particular, and competitive mountain biking. Are we looking at a situation where that could be happening here? We just had a local girl compete in the BMX World Championships. She also competes at a collegiate level on mountain biking, both slalom and downhill. Are those things that could be incorporated in Dollar Mountain?
Absolutely, and we already have a couple of community groups out there wanting to bring downhill mountain biking events to the Dollar Mountain system once it's fully completed. And one of the groups is even talking about creating like a high school team for downhill mountain biking. It's one of these great locations because we're so centralized in our region that we'd be able to bring in a lot of different communities to
easy access with transportation.
Yeah, it's right off I-5 there, so it's easy to get to. The trail system itself is well-marked and easy to navigate. And then, you know, over in Coos Bay, they've got a mountain biking team. They've got a couple of mountain biking teams down in the Jackson County area. So it really ties in well to that type of a circuit that they could create. And that was a large push for this system, was to create a better circuit for people that just were traveling here for mountain biking, because there's a bunch of trails down in Jackson County. You've got Mountain of the Rogue State Parks, Dollar Mountain, Coos Bay with Whiskey Run and things like that. So we really created the Southern Oregon circuit for people traveling and competing.
How are we going to stack up against Coos Bay and Ashland and in those areas? Well, we going to be competitive?
We're going to be competitive. The same builder that built Whiskey Run is the one we're using to build Dollar Mountain, so that's a good tie-in for that, as well as he also was one of the people that did a lot of the last work over at Mountain of the Rogues today, or Mountain of the Rogue. So, you know, it's going to definitely be competitive. On the Highland Loop side, it's definitely more of the easy cross-country style mountain biking. The Crescent side, which would be, you know, northwest of the cell tower, that's going to be the more technical terrain side. It's got, you know, a lot more steeper grades and everything like that, which is what a lot of the out-of-town guests and things like that are really looking for, is that more advanced system. So, you know, the system itself has a little bit of something for everybody. So we're going to be able to cast a pretty wide net for it.
All right. So that could be very exciting come next spring when that more of it is in place then.
Yeah. And really the nice thing about this location being in Grants Pass is it's going to be a real big hit for the shoulder season riders. You know, it's going to be great early, late fall, and then early spring and things like that, you know. Day like today, we're not going to have a lot of people out there mountain biking. But when
only if it's downhill.
Yeah, a lot of people, when they don't go over to like Whiskey Run because it's in their torrential downpour season type of a thing on the southern northern coast, they're still going to be able to come here. Same with the folks that like to go over to Bend when it starts getting snowy and everything over here. Our weather is very mild to be able to have more of that off-season usage.
All right. Exciting. All right. We're down to about our last 5 minutes here, Josh. What do we need to know about the Parks Department, either that we haven't touched on today or that we need to recap?
The other thing I just throw out there is right now the city is doing a request for expression of interest for the Riverside Park Caretaker's Cottage. This is the small house that's located on West Park Street next to the maintenance shop. Essentially, we're asking people in the community, any sort of private businesses out there, whether or not they'd be interested in using this location and what their ideas would be. And, you know, this one closes on August 29th by 3 p.m. And you can find the full details with the request for information on the city website to be able to put that out there to see, you know, if there is a use in this community for this structure and then what that kind of use would be.
All right. So, and that building has historical significance. That's why it's still here, right?
So in 2018, Riverside Park was added to the historic registry, and the building itself is from the 1920s and used to be the caretaker's cottage, and it was added as a contributing structure to that. So it provides some form of historical significance and protection. It's just less so than like the main park itself. But before the city goes and like demolishes it or just lets it continue to sit vacant, you know, we got to do our due diligence to see what exactly is out there that may be a better community use.
See what kind of value we can get out of that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Josh, thank you very much. People, if they have any questions about parks, where do they call?
They can go ahead and call our parks line, or they could just call my office. It's 541-450-6160. All of our contact information is located on our city website under the parks tab and everything like that.
Hey, thank you very much. Yeoman work. We appreciate it.
Yep.
All right. Aaron, anything happening else with the city that we need to know about?
Well, I hope from today's conversation that your listeners are hearing about all the positive things that are happening here. And it's great to come into the end of the summer season and getting ready for fall. And we have a lot of wind in our sails right now. It's great with all the park improvements that we're doing and the things that are going to be able to provide additional capacity for recreational uses in our parks is amazing to the dissolve of the injunction and our opportunity to regulate all of our public spaces to additional looking at having a discussion with council on hiring additional firefighters and police officers to help with that issue and our bandwidth that we have and to our new water treatment plant that's happening there to our grant program for the unhoused and getting a service provider in there to help alleviate some of those issues also. We have so many positive things happening. It's very exciting time for Grants Pass.
More development in the Spalding Industrial Area?
More development in the Spalding Industrial Area. We've got a catalyst project up there in the Washington area where we have an urban renewal agency project we're discussing with council. There's just so many great things going on. The development of a Main Street program for downtown in the Central Business District area. The energy is really high, and it's exciting to see all these things starting to come about. And it's if you look at it and you plan it out, we have got some great things ahead of us. So we're very excited about the future.
Well, it's let me add to that. We've for years been following some things that have been certainly frustrating on your level and our level and this public's level to see some of those things at least with the end in sight or a resolution in sight might be a better way.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much. You've been listening to the Tuesday Talk Show here on KAJO Radio. I'm Chuck Benson. You stay tuned. Alex Bauer on his way here on KAJO Radio.